picking back up here, I always look forward to this one. I think this is the third we've done. I think so. Have we done two? I think we've done more than just the one last year. Your topic last year was way better than mine. I put some thought into mine, and this is something that I am genuinely interested in, that I think about a lot. I think especially because of where we live. And I'm going to start.
Well, let's just first say if there's someone that just happens to tune into this one for their first time, one episode a year, we don't
say the B
word. Don't talk at all about bikes.
That's
the only time I'll say the word. Yeah. Okay. Usually this is a cycling podcast. This is the one episode where we each talk about something other than bikes.
In the spirit of taking mid-season breaks, don't listen to this first. There's another episode that came out today that we'll have published before.
Yeah, listen
this.
To that one first.
Just pause, go listen to the other one, then come back to this. But for the majority of you who I think followed the instructions you saw in the first title of the first episode, which is like, don't worry, there's another one coming. Listen to this one first. We're not going to say the B words. There will be no more discussion of that. We're going to leave it behind. And I'm going to start, we're going to do mine first. And I'm going to start mine by asking you, Dan, what is the most remote place you've ever been?
You know, I've like, oh God, remote. Like remote as far as like the likelihood of someone, another human being ever being there.
It's interesting that you already start with that question. How would you, maybe let's start with this. How do you define remote?
Well, there's
how
a couple ways. Like remote could be, like the farthest away from like civilization or a city or something, or that would be remote. But then also just like being somewhere where the likelihood that another human being has ever been there before might be, because like Thunderbolt or something, you know, I've hiked back up in there where hardly anyone ever goes, but it's like 2 miles from a big huge city,
right?
You know, so it's like remote, but not really.
So this is interesting. You are kind of hitting on maybe the hardest aspect of this topic for me, because I had a lot of things in mind, and this has evolved several times, but I kind of ended up landing on the question, what are like the most remote places out there? And the immediate problem is like, how do you define remote? Right? Because I was like looking, and there's all these lists you can find online, and I drew heavily from some of them, like what's the most remote town in the US or whatever, right? And it's interesting because there are towns in Utah, I'm going to go over, where it's like, it's this itty bitty teeny little town, but it's really close. It's like 30 minutes away from another itty bitty teeny tiny town. But both of those are really far away from everything else. Versus there's this one town in Montana that, I think it was Glasgow, Montana, that's a fairly decently sized place as small towns go, but it is really far away from anything else. But it itself has a store, has some basic stuff, where there's some communities in Utah where there's several of them close together, but there's like not a gas station, right? So I want to say at the outset that like I've kind of collected this random list of just very remote places by different definitions. And the other thing is like a remote town is not truly remote because it's a town. There are people there versus just the most remote.
Or are you going to talk about, was it Esplin, Utah? Or what is
Eskdale, Utah?
Eskdale.
So this is one, let's start here. This is interesting. Utah is a really geographically interesting place because most of us live along I-15, right? Like most of us live in Salt Lake, in the Salt Lake metropolitan area, in Utah County, and then up kind of in the Cache Valley, there's like the Logan area, and then there's St. George. Those are the big areas of Utah, and they all kind of fall on I-15, right? Like the pattern of settlement here, the road truly follows the pattern of settlement, right? But the point is most of us kind of live in this corridor. You go east or west of that, and then start going up or down, there are very, very few people here. The only draw, and like, and there's kind of two interesting areas of Utah I'm going to talk about today. One of them is the southeastern corner of Utah, which is basically National Park Utah, like Moab, Arches Canyonlands, you know, like Capitol Reef, like all of that stuff. But there's this other really interesting slice of Utah, which is the far west slice of Utah, north of St. George, which is really interesting. Eskdale is not that remote, is what I landed on. I thought of Eskdale. Eskdale is a really interesting little town where there's this offshoot. It's a non-polygamous kind of offshoot of the LDS church that's totally its own thing, where basically a whole bunch of people in like the 50s and 60s that were in the LDS church followed this guy down to a very arid, not nice place.
Wasn't he a chiropractor?
Something like that. It was in that kind of bubble of... Anyway, Yeah, it was in the kind of bubble of nonsense. But like, it was basically, they followed this crazy guy, not to stamp on anyone's beliefs, down. And there's this town called Eskdale, Utah, that is very far away from stuff, but it's actually kind of in a cluster of other similar small towns. Now, granted, and I'm kind of jumping into this already, like, that part of Utah is truly very remote. It is so remote that there's not even really settlement of indigenous people living there, because it sucks. It's like basically not arable. Like, you can grow very little down there. There's very little, like, economically drawing people down there, because like, there's a lot that draws people to southeastern Utah. Not a ton of people live there, but at any given point in time, there are a ton of human beings in southeastern Utah. There's tons of recreation. It is maybe the most beautiful place on the planet that we live on. The other side of Utah, kind of bordering Nevada, is ugly. Like, it's, every place is beautiful in its own way, right? But it's like, it's not a beautiful place that you'd go. It's mostly like small unincorporated ranching communities where it's like, it has a name, but it's really just several ranches, right? But truly, like, Eskdale is like, is not that far from other stuff. Like, getting to a grocery store or a gas station from Eskdale take longer than it does here, but they're out there. There are, and I'm going to start here, I'm going to start talking about the most remote towns in Utah and then the most remote place in Utah. Most remote places is equally hard to decide on, because is it like, the best definition I could come up for it with is like, how far are you from a road, right? And maybe you could look at it this way, like, what would be the worst place to have your appendix rupture? Like, how far are you? And with like, you know, like, you can life flight. I mean, Jacob works at the U Hospital. They get people life flighted from Montana all the time, right? So like, I think the bottom line, one of, just to kind of start in my introduction with the bottom line is nowhere is that remote anymore, right? Like, very few places on the planet are like truly hard to get to. I'm actually going to talk about one or two later on. But yeah, like, there, I'll start with the most remote place in Utah is, do you want to take a guess where it is? Just the most geographically, like, you could have computer software tell you where the point that is farthest from a road in Utah.
Somewhere south of Delta.
No, you're totally wrong.
Okay.
When I say it, it'll be kind of obvious, because think it's not hard to build roads out there. There are roads out there. The definition of remote point, we're saying farthest from a road. So think about, where is it hard to put roads? It is in the High Uintas. And again, depending on how you define remote, that might be
better. How do you define roads? Does that have to be paved?
They said no.
Doesn't have to be paved.
Does not have to be paved. So the farthest point in Utah from the nearest road is in the High Uintas. I couldn't actually find it on a map, but several people have gone there. I'm sure if I spent months and talked to the right people, they could show me on their GPS coordinates. But it is about 9.5 miles from the nearest road, which is interesting for a couple of reasons. Because
that
doesn't sound like that far, which just kind of goes to show that, like, humanity has gone everywhere. We've built, you can find a road. Now, whether or not that road is traveled frequently is another question. But there's not really anywhere you can go in Utah where you're more than 10 miles from the nearest road.
There's got to be like some place west of I-15 that you just keep going west towards Nevada or whatever.
I should say, we're being extremely generous when it comes to what constitutes a road. So out in the Salt Flats is all basically a road. Occasionally people can drive through there, right? Like, there's big chunks of Utah where you're maybe farther from the nearest person, but farther from the nearest person changes all the time. Like, the military will set up something for 2 weeks to do testing somewhere, right? So the point here is, like, the farthest point where people just don't really go, right? And as near as I can tell, there is not really anywhere in Utah that no one has ever been before. There is actually a place in the contiguous United States I'm going to talk about in a sec where it is contended there are going to be areas where just people have never been, which,
like,
is actually
a swamp somewhere.
Kind of. And again, there's no way to know this for sure. And so this is why it's such a slippery question, because it's really hard to know, where have people been? Where do people frequently go? Because again, out in the western part of Utah, there are ranchers. There is stuff going on. Like, you'd probably, like, if you broke both of your legs and were just lying there on the road, there are definitely places in Utah where people aren't going to pass you for weeks and you're going to die, right? But in the High Uintas, there is a point 9.5 miles from the nearest anything that could be considered a road. It is a 2-day trek from the nearest trailhead on foot. It is in the boonies. It's in the sticks. Not very many people go there. It's near Moon Lake. Basically, you start from Moon Lake in the Uintas, which is a major lake, and you hike from there. And so again, like, you can kind of look at this as like, is that really that remote? You can get there in just 2 days, right? But yeah, like mathematically, by this specific person's definition of what constitutes remote, that is remote, right? And I'm sure not a ton of people go there, but people do go there, right? Like if you were incapacitated there on the trail, either someone's going to find you or someone's going to find your body relatively quickly, right? But again, in the High Uintas, there's like the Garrett Bardsley's body was never found. Granted, it sounds like he was probably like eaten, you know, but so it's like the Uintas are remote, but they're not remote enough that like they're like pretty much anywhere in the Uintas that you go, someone has been there before, right? Towns are more interesting to me in some ways in terms of remoteness, because a town itself is not remote. There's other people there, right? It's on a map, you know, like there's a few towns, like I couldn't really land on what their most remote town in Utah was. There are three I'm going to run over. Eskdale is remote. I want to say for what it's worth, Eskdale is a remote place. But there are a few others that I think have a better argument for why they're the most remote. Now, if you Google most remote town in Utah, the one that comes up most is Boulder. And I don't actually think this is true. I think I would argue Boulder is not the most remote town in Utah. Boulder is in southeastern Utah. It's another one of those kind of national park area towns. There's about 250 people that live there. So it's a very small. But you can drive 40 minutes out of Boulder and get to Escalante, which you've probably heard of, Escalante, Utah, right? This is in the kind of Capitol Reef, Grand Staircase, Escalante area. You could walk between Boulder and Escalante in a day if you needed to, right? It's a 40-minute drive, not big roads or anything, but it is very remote. But there are stores there. Like, I look, there's a gas station, you know? So, like, Hanksville is another one that you'd throw out. Now, Hanksville, you'd have to drive about an hour in either direction to either Green River or Torrey, right? But Hanksville's also very touristy. Like, at any given point, like, not that many people live in Hanksville, but because of, like, Capitol Reef and Goblin Valley, there are a lot of people who pass through Hanksville. So Hanksville on a map is definitely more remote than Boulder, but I think Boulder would feel more remote than Hanksville because there are more services in Hanksville. It's more, there's places to stay. Like, you go to Boulder if you know someone in Boulder, for the most part. People do still pass through, like, you know, with Grand Staircase and Capitol Reef and stuff. The one that I landed on that I think has the best argument for being the most remote, and I'll say up front, it is not a town. It is an unincorporated community. It's called Grouse Creek. Have you ever heard of Grouse Creek, Utah?
I've heard of the mountains, the Grouse Creek Mountains.
There you go. They're beautiful. It's in that area, in the very far northwest corner of Utah. It's closer to Idaho. Like, they use services from Idaho. Like, their electrical service comes from Malta, Idaho. Now, again, Grouse Creek is not a town. And this is where it's a little tricky, where these places could claim to be the most remote. But Grouse Creek isn't, like, a proper city. There's not, like, a city hall. Grouse Creek truly is a collection of families. It's a collection of ranches is probably the better way to put it. But it does have a permanent population of just over 100 people. And it is about an hour and a half from the nearest city in either direction. Wendover is your nearest big city. And so for Grouse Creek, and this is one, Grouse Creek has a community store. And it looks like you can get some basic work clothes and you can get some basic food and stuff. But from what I could gather, people in Grouse Creek just do periodic trips to Wendover to go to Smith's. Like, your nearest Smith's is an hour and a half away in Wendover, which itself is not, like, a huge city. Like, Wendover is not some metropolis, right? But that's the nearest, like, large-ish city where there's, like, a McDonald's and a Smith's and a bank and everything, right? And think about the way that those people live. Like, there's a school that can accommodate kids younger than 11th grade, but in 11th and 12th grade, it kind of gets difficult, and those kids basically get sent away for school, from what I can tell. But again, you could argue Grouse Creek isn't the most remote town in Utah because it's not a town, right? And this is where it gets hard, where it's like, is a ranch a town? Because there are families in Utah who live in ranches that are not even incorporated because it's just the one, and there is a permanent population there. But those places don't even appear on a map. Like, those people don't go out of the way to put stuff about them online. So this is, it's really kind of hard to say. Like, those are several places in Utah that you could argue are the most remote place. The most remote place in the continental U.S. kind of surprised me. And this is mathematical remoteness. Again, kind of like that place in the High Uintas. Place that is farthest from a road. Do you want to guess where that would be in the continental U.S.? And think with
Texas somewhere.
It is not in Texas. Texas is covered with roads. Oh, okay. And I thought Nevada, but Nevada is also covered with roads, right? Like, there's roads that are marked on maps that people occasionally have reasons to go. Think, what place?
Alaska.
As a continental U.S.
Oh, continental. Idaho somewhere?
Wyoming? Closer. It's in Yellowstone. It is in Yellowstone National Park. It is 22 miles from the nearest road. And this is where it confused me. It said 22 miles from the nearest road, but to actually get there requires a hike that is round trip 75 miles. So they said it takes about a week to get to this place on foot. The only other way to get to this place is by helicopter. Now, granted, we're in a
national... Has that one couple been out there?
Yes, they have. And this is interesting. So this place, they said, was genuinely difficult to get to. You cannot drive to this place, if nothing else, because it would be illegal. Like, you can't just go drive bushwhacking your Jeep through a national park, right?
Could you snowmobile?
I don't know what the rules are with snowmobiling in national parks. I'd imagine so, because that's not going to, like, destroy
the... Yellowstone all the time.
Probably, but this would be... In the winter, I wouldn't risk going out to this place. You're really far away from anything. And then I don't know if, like, in the winter...
And
like,
is there actually a destination?
On a map, yeah. Because, again, they're using software, and it's like, this coordinate is the farthest you get from a road, okay. Right? But they said they went to this place. They said it was disappointing because they could make a really good argument that this is the most remote place in the United States. They said there was a cabin there. Like, there was totally evidence. It didn't look like people had been there recently. But there's very few places you can go in the continental U.S. that people haven't gone, except, and this is disputed... There are some people who make good arguments that there are areas of central Idaho that are so remote and so hard to get to that you could argue people have probably never been. Now, human beings have been on this continent for over 10,000 years, and we have no, and most of them didn't have like robust permanent civilizations until more like a couple millennia ago, right? So we don't know this, but they say that within the continental U.S., the most likely place that a person has never been is probably somewhere in Idaho. But even then,
why is that?
It's just really high. They said it was like a combination of complex factors where it was like really high it's and like really far from roads, high elevation and bad conditions.
Is it in a mountain range somewhere?
Yes, it is in the high mountains of central Idaho, is what people say. So, because you think in plains, people claim plains. So you have to think where like people, when white people came out to the West, the biggest driver was like, there was the gold rush, right? But there's also just the whole, if you get to this place and plant your flag, it's your land. Basically, the government gave out free land to encourage people to come out west, right? It was like the biggest wealth giveaway probably in the history of humanity, right? Where people would start on a start line and have their wagon go out, and they got to the place first, they claimed it, right? So you have to think, anywhere flat and remotely arable is a place that someone has been before because they've planted crops there or they've had cattle grazing there, right? But you get up high into the mountains where the conditions are really extreme, where it gets really, really cold in the winter, and the terrain is too rocky for a wagon to get into, and there's not a road for your Jeep to get into, where basically you're dealing with people deliberately hiking there because it's pretty. Short of that, and so this is why it's like you can never prove for sure that nobody's ever been there, but they say the area in the U.S. that has the best chance of you being able to see a place that no one has ever seen is in the high mountains of central Idaho.
So like
is the contention of this one.
How big of an area does it have to be to count? Like for instance.
Yes. Right.
For instance, like you know, I was riding up Mill Creek on the pipeline the other day.
Yeah.
And I was looking and there's just like a bunch of little cute little peaks that are full of pine trees.
Right.
That come to like a really pointy peak, but they're full of trees.
They're totally tree covered, right?
So it'd be hard to get up there.
Really hard. Has
anyone ever stood on the peak of that?
Who knows? And that's the interesting thing. And you know what? Maybe not. Actually for sure not. Like there are for sure places in the U.S. So it's like,
so
I
it's
think
like
by
maybe
his...
you could be the first person to ever be in like a 100-foot square
I think
area.
This guy's definition was to see a view, which means a pretty big area.
Pretty big area.
Right? Because for sure, like there's probably places in my neighborhood where technically no one's ever set foot before, right? I think this is more like to see a place, like you know, like explorers, like when Lewis and Clark came through the U.S., it was big enough and really, truly, like north, like south, I read this really interesting book, like South and Central America were arguably more populated than Europe prior to the European colonization of the Americas, right? North America wasn't. North America's really harsh. Like, Utah's a harsh place. Like, you can grow crops here, but, like, we kind of stretch to, we waste a ridiculous amount of water making Utah arable, right? Utah is not a place that you bother kicking around. There weren't a ton of, like, animals to hunt. You know, a lot of Utah's pretty empty. So, like, sure, like, up at Mill Creek and throughout the Rockies, there are absolutely places where there just wasn't a great reason for people to have been. And to this day, people probably still haven't been. I think in this guy, the one I drew.
So I want to find
a
peak up Mill Creek and be the first to be on the top of it.
You could probably make an argument for having done that, but then you have to think that like a million people live in the Salt Lake Valley, and a lot of them like to hike. So you never know, right? Yeah. The most remote town in the U.S. This one was easier to land on, and I think this is going by practical remoteness, like actual difficulty to get to this town. Is called Supai, Arizona. It is a community that's like 97% indigenous people, the Supai tribe. Most of them live in this little town. It is at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. It's a very, very old place. They've been there for a very long time. There are no roads. There's not a car in this town. You cannot get a car there. It is accessible.
How many people live there?
There are, this is about 200,
it
varies. It is a town though. It's an actual honest to God town. The U.S. Postal Service delivers mail there by mule. And I'm not kidding. There are three ways to access this town. You have to walk down to it or take a mule or helicopter. And it is not economically feasible for the mail to be delivered via helicopter every single day. So someone genuinely, for practical reasons, loads a mule with letters and prescription medications and everything else that people have shipped and takes it to this actual town at the bottom of the Grand Canyon.
Do they get that much mail each day that it takes an entire mule to carry it?
The United States Postal Service carries an enormous amount of stuff.
Do they have that? Like, you'd think that small of a town... A letter carrier could put in a backpack.
Do you know what a ton of what the USPS... I actually read about this too, because I was surprised. I'm like, oh, do people write letters anymore, right? It's mostly shipping things. It's mostly stuff. And you got to think, if they're that remote, they don't have a Walgreens.
That's true.
And a lot of these people have diabetes and
but
other
how do they order stuff if they don't have the internet?
They have the internet there. You have satellite internet.
Okay.
Yeah, you have a satellite there. And that's how these people live. They have satellite and phone service. It's expensive, but they have it. You know, they're not going to have like, I don't imagine they have running water, but you can still have you have running water, but not
from
like
a well.
Exactly from a well. Right. And it was actually really interesting to learn about people who live in these areas. There are some special considerations, but you can still do it. Right. So if you have a heart attack there, a helicopter's picking you up and flying you to the nearest hospital in Arizona. Hmm. Right. And in a similar way, if you have a heart attack in Grouse Creek, a hospital like Life Flight's going to leave from the U here in Salt Lake, come and pick you up and fly you back to the U. There are areas of Montana where people fly to the Salt Lake Hospital. Right? So like remoteness in the 21st century is never that, and I'm actually going to get, there are still a couple places that are genuinely very difficult to reach where you don't want to have a medical emergency. But like Supai, Arizona, I feel pretty confident saying like there's technically a town in Montana that I mentioned that is farther on a map from other stuff, but there's still a road, mm-hmm. You know, like you can still drive places, but Supai, Arizona is a place with a permanent population that is really difficult to reach. Like I said, the most remote.
Do tourists ever go there?
Oh, yeah. It's very touristy. But that's the other thing is a lot of these places aren't a remote but touristy place. Mm-hmm. So Supai, Arizona, their economy is mostly tourism. It's people who are hiking to the bottom of the Grand Canyon and buying a souvenir or whatever, right? Mm. The biggest chunks of the U.S. that are truly remote, people think Texas. It is not Texas. A ton of people live in Texas. Texas is large, but it's not like... It's still fairly densely populated. There are areas of Texas that are very remote, but they're all connected by roadways. It's like ranches and stuff. There are portions of, I mentioned central Idaho and then Nevada too, that are truly very remote because they're not arable. There's not a good reason for people to be there, but there are still roads. Now, what do you think is the most remote place? And I should say the most remote place in the U.S. is Alaska. Alaska, Canada, and Russia are just also places where there's like incredibly far north Arctic swamps that are incredibly difficult to get through. You're flying to places. Those places are far and away the most remote on land. Like there are absolutely places in Russia and Canada and Alaska where no one's ever been for sure. But you would have to risk your life to go to some godforsaken marsh. Like there's truly no reason to get there. The more interesting one to me, and this is that I'll end here because I've already eaten up a fair chunk of time. What do you think is the most remote place on this planet? And I'm going to say most remote town.
A town in Mongolia.
No, not even close. Think the ocean. I'll give you a hint. It's an island in the ocean.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm saying on this planet, the most remote settlement on this planet.
Somewhere near Tonga.
It's not in the Pacific, which is in, I assumed it would be in the Pacific, but the Pacific is actually kind of islanded. Like in the Pacific, there'll be islands. I mean, we say close in oceanic terms, like close-ish by. It is an island called Tristan da Cunha, which is like a volcanic island that rose out of nowhere, right? Because in the Pacific, a lot of it's like the plates meet or whatever, and so there's like volcanic islands there. I'm not a scientist, so that might be inaccurate. But it is actually between South America and Africa, pretty far south, just to kind of orient you. It's an island called Tristan da Cunha, which you might have heard of before. I'd heard of this. The town is called Edinburgh of the Seven Seas. It is the most remote inhabited settlement in the world, and it's not even close. Like, think about those places we were talking about in Russia or Canada. You are still way closer to other people and arguably easier to access to other people than Tristan da Cunha. It's a volcanic island. It's part of a five-island archipelago, but there's this main one, and there is a permanent population of a few hundred people. It is 1,750 miles away from Cape Town, South Africa, and the journey to get there takes about a week. You have to take a combination of crazy flights. Like, I think to get there from London takes like over a week, right? You have to fly to Cape Town, and then you get on a series of small boats and small planes. But the thing is, it's so far that a big plane can't land on an island that small. They don't have a runway big enough for like a 747. So you have to do like island hopping in little planes or getting on a boat or whatever. And those people, like, they get a shipment of stuff once every month or something. Like, it is well and truly remote. I think there's some kind of medical center there. It's part of some other country, right? So you can get like medical attention there on the island. But if you had to get like major surgery or something, you'd be in a bad situation where, like, if you had to go see a specialist, it would take you, I mean, they could probably rush you if your life depended on it, but we're talking days. Hmm. Like, and this is the coolest fact in here. Those people, most of the time, almost all of the time, the closest people to them are the astronauts who crew the International Space Station. They pass over, the space station passes over that island. Those people are generally the closest human beings to them. The people in space are way closer than the other people,
like,
on Earth.
Why do people live there? And do tourists ever go there? And
you know what? I don't, like, a lot of, like, these
is
islands.
Is there an industry there?
Yeah, because people basically want to go there to say it's, and it's a beautiful place. It's this cool volcanic island in the middle of the ocean. It's a cool place to go. Hmm. The pictures were beautiful. And people do occasionally go there. There's also a lot of science that happens there. A lot of scientists will go to study different things that happen there. But yeah, like this made me realize just how big the ocean is. The most remote point in the world is called Point Nemo, and I believe that is in the Pacific. That's, again, like going by math, looking at a map or whatever. And it's and when you're at Point Nemo, like you're properly, you're like 5,000 miles away from the nearest thing, right? Mm-hmm. But boats pass through there all the time. So like it was an interesting exercise to see that like the world's been pretty well explored. The next stuff that we get to explore is going to be in space or at the bottom of the ocean. Pretty much no matter where you go in the world, a person has been there and probably will be there again at some point in the future. But it made me appreciate that, like, we live here in Salt Lake. We are not that far from some pretty remote stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to someday, you know, kind of go explore those weird parts of Western Utah where there's these strange little towns and stuff.
I want to go out and ride around Boulder. That sounds fun.
Yeah, that would actually be really, really cool out there. But yeah, there's my thing.
Wow.
Oh, no, we mentioned a ride.
Oh, whoops, sorry.
No! Oh!
Okay, never mind.
Okay, well, we've tainted this episode. There you go. So.
Oh, is it my turn?
Time to hang up on my thing.
Okay, I'm going to wake up and talk about
was
my
that
thing.
Was boring?
No, that wasn't boring. Do you guys think it was boring? I don't think so.
I thought that was really interesting. And you know what? You could go so much deeper than I have into this.
So mine, at first I thought was pretty innocent.
Okay.
And then it kind of got a little weird. And a little creepy.
Okay.
But I thought it was interesting. And
very defensive off the bat here, Dan.
Yeah, and I hope other people at least think it's interesting. And well, I was really curious about. So
I'll hear you out.
So I was talking to a buddy of mine at work. Okay. I work in the construction industry. He was at a job site, and this job site was kind of out in the boonies. It was out like someone was building a fancy cabin up in Colville.
Okay.
And there was an excavator there, or he wasn't an excavator. He was actually more of a farmer there, but he had like a backhoe, and he was using the backhoe, and he was looking for water lines before he would dig.
Okay.
And he had these two, he was holding these two wires in his hands, and he was walking around with the two wires. And when the wires would automatically cross, he would mark there that there was a water line there.
I've heard of this before.
Have you heard of this before?
Isn't it like you can find wells? Like it was like a thing where they say if the sticks want to cross, yeah, there's water. Okay,
yeah.
I've heard.
It's called dowsing. And
I've heard of this before.
I had never heard of that before. And I'm like, and he told me about this. I'm like, wow, that's kind of interesting. I thought like there's no way that could work. There's no way that could be a thing.
So question at the outset, is this a supernatural thing we're talking about or is this science?
That's what we're talking about. Like,
so I'll out myself. I am a very supernatural skeptical person. I'm in that camp. And I think you are generally in the more embrace the supernatural camp.
No, I don't believe it. I just think it's fun to.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. You know, I think it's fun to kind of talk about and stuff.
Okay. This is interesting.
Yeah. So I'm kind of like, and I had never heard of this before. So he told me, and as soon as he walked away, I started like Googling about it and stuff. Yeah. And like, apparently it's kind of a thing. And like, there's like a lot of old timers and farmers and stuff will use this to help find wells and where underground water is.
What was this called again?
Dowsing.
Dowsing.
And there's actually other names for it too. But then there's actually kind of a supernatural side to it where people use it to detect ghosts and talk to spirits from the other side. And that's where it kind of started in it. Like I was curious, like, if this actually worked, like, if it's, like, these metal sticks are picking up some electromagnetic field from the water that interrupts it or something. But then I started realizing that, like, people use it to detect ghosts and...
Okay, so not everything that the supernatural world touches is BS, right? Like, and this annoys people, I think, all the time, who do actual scientific stuff that has some kind of a... Like, I was reading something about this guy who genuinely, his job is to research UAPs, like unidentified aerial phenomena, right? Where it's like, it could mean it's a new Russian missile, it could mean it's an asteroid, whatever. But he said that his work, it's hard because people associate it with UFOs. Is this kind of the thing where there's a real science thing, but then people use it for other stuff?
So, I don't think it's real science, but I think it points out something really interesting.
Okay.
And I don't know. I thought this was interesting. Hopefully you guys do too. But here I've got a whole lot of my source basically is Wikipedia.
Okay.
And I never use Wikipedia, and I'm actually going to be reading straight from Wikipedia on a lot of things. Just
Wikipedia is not a bad source. That's a hill I'll die on. Like, it's really, if you understand how Wikipedia works, like
it's really not bad.
It's really not a bad source.
I was amazed at how much was in this on Wikipedia. Like I had no idea this was even a thing till just a few weeks ago. So, but according to Wikipedia, dowsing is a type of divination employed in attempts to locate groundwater, buried metals or ores, gemstones, oil, claimed radiation, earth vibrations, and many other objects and materials without the use of scientific apparatus. It is also known as divining.
So divination, like I learned that word when I read the Harry Potter books. Like that is not a science word. And for Wikipedia to start right out of the gates, that doesn't sound science.
Yeah, it's not sciencey. Divining, doodle bugging is another term for it. I kind of like that. That should be our word.
Sounds like a euphemism for something.
That should be our word for the...
Doodle bugging is officially the word.
Water finding or water witching. Okay.
Okay.
So what, well, let me show you. I actually,
no, we have a demonstration.
I do. I made some,
okay.
I made some,
so this will be interesting because you're going to have to put the mic down to do this.
Dowsing rods. And I'm kind of not sure how I'm going to do this.
This takes two hands.
Maybe I can do it.
I will describe what's going on.
Okay.
So Dan's going to set down his mic.
I'm going to set down my mic.
Make an awful clattery noise probably. Okay. So no, that not. I don't think so. So Dan has two rods that look like really like L's. They're like a really long L, and he has two of them. Okay, and he's holding them up. Now Dan's grabbing them from like the bending point, and he's holding. So basically, really quick, it looks like Dan's holding two like very rudimentary pistols. Like you found a flag on the ground that marked sprinklers when you were a kid. Imagine that, but he's bent it just enough for there to be a handle, so that they can kind of swing freely. And he's moving them together so that these sticks that stick out really far from the ends of his hands are kind of waving side to side as he's moving around.
Okay, but then
He can't. They can't hear you. Let me hold up the mic to Dan here, please.
Okay. But then when I'm holding these sticks, they're pointing straight. But when I get over a source of water, they'll cross without me moving them. I'm holding them loosely, kind of letting them do their own thing. But as soon as I get over water, they'll cross.
Okay, so now Dan is searching for groundwater in our basement. He's walking into the laundry room, and they're crossing. Okay, so he says, watch this. Now he's walking to the bathroom, and as he walks to the bathroom, they're crossing. So,
but did you notice
it
was in the same line?
I have to do this. Hang on. Okay, now he's walking. Okay, we're doing more science here. Are they crossing? I can't see you. You're in the hallway.
Right about here.
So it's the same. Dan's contention is that there's a water line that runs through all three places of. Okay. So we're gonna try this. Okay.
Okay. Joe's gonna try the same thing. Hold them loosely. So they're. Okay. They should. Hold them loosely. Okay. Now walk towards. Keep going. It didn't cross yet. Did it cross?
Hang on. This is dumb. Let me just confirm.
No, wait.
This is extremely stupid. This is so dumb. I can explain what's going on here. This is dumb. Okay. So this is okay. There you go. Okay, so let me explain what happens. Okay, hang on. Give me my mic back. Give me my mic. You're done. You've lost your privileges. So what's happening here? Depending on how you tilt your wrist. So watch this. So I'm holding it. If I hold my wrist very straight, it'll point straight. If I tilt my wrist a little bit to the left, it'll point left. If I tilt my so what happens is the only people who will ever do this are people who really want it to work, okay? You don't have like physics professors going out and doing this, okay? You have people who already are biased to believe this is going to work, and when they cross over somewhere where they know there's likely to be groundwater, they're maybe even unconsciously, this might be a really earnest thing, they want it to work. You tilt your wrists in a little bit. I can make it. So watch this. Okay. Your head's full of water. Whoa, look at that. Look, there's water down there too. I don't mean to be that guy, but this just seems like this is not.
Well, I noticed when you walked past that point.
Yeah.
The sticks like went outwards. Like you were purposely exactly. trying to get them to go outwards.
But that's kind of my point.
Yeah. Like
we'd have to set up a rig that can't tilt where they're just held perfectly evenly and then see what they do.
Excuse me, but there's actually an explanation, which is called the. So I don't know if I'm going to say this right. The ideo monitor phenomenon. IDEO. Oh no, I said that wrong. Ideo motor phenomenon.
Ideo motor phenomenon.
Ideo motor phenomenon.
Okay.
Which I'm going to read. I'm reading right from Wikipedia.
Okay.
The ideo motor phenomenon is a physiological phenomenon wherein a subject makes motions unconsciously. Also called ideomotor response.
That's exactly what I said.
Yeah, which is abbreviated to IMR, is a concept in hypnosis and in psychology or psychological research. It is derived from the terms ideo or idea, and motor, which is muscular action. The phrase is most commonly used in reference to a process whereby a thought or mental image brings about a seemingly reflexive or automatic muscular reaction, often of a minuscule degree and potentially outside awareness of the subject. In response to a pain, the body sometimes reacts reflexively with an ideomotor effect to the ideas alone without the person consciously deciding to take action. The effects of automatic writing, dowsing, facilitated communication, and applied kinesiology, and Ouija boards have been attributed to this phenomenon.
So this is actually, this is interesting. And this is, I'm sure this is kind of where your research led you. Like, this does explain a lot of stuff where, again, like, and this is confirmation bias, right? Human beings, everybody does this. And trying not to do it is great, but by default, human beings seek out ways to prove things that they're already inclined to believe. All
oh,
of
absolutely.
Us have worldviews and biases, and we look for things that confirm those, and we don't like things that challenge our worldview, right?
Oh, yeah. Anytime I'm like, it's hard to not have a bias when you're like, even when I'm getting ready for like podcast episodes, it's hard for me to put away my biases and find research that would disagree with something that I already kind of believe, you know?
Like, well, this is how psychic reading works, right? Is that you have a whole bunch of people who go to see a psychic who are statistically overwhelmingly likely to be people who believe in psychics, right? And then the psychic will say, ooh, I'm feeling an energy coming from someone on this half of the room had a family member who recently died of heart disease, right? Which is an incredibly statistically likely thing to be true. And I'm not likable saying this. I know, really quick, I sound so unlikable right now because I'm raining all over everything. And this sounds really arrogant. And I'm just going to set that aside. That is like that's how like John Edwards, that douchebag guy that South Park made fun of all the time in the early 2000s, it was like on every morning news show, right? Like he would just make statistically likely guesses about like, ooh, someone had a relative die whose last name starts with M. You know, like there's, you're dealing with almost a certainty that somebody in this crowd of 100 people could find some connection to that because they're looking for it. Or Ouija boards, right? Where the hand points to whatever letter. You give me any letter and I can think of something in my life that could be significant tied to that letter. So that's kind of what we're talking about here, right?
Well, yeah. And as I was researching this more, I realized that there's like a lot of people that will hold out these dowsing rods. And they will ask like the spirits questions, and if the answer is yes, they'll cross.
Right.
And if not, they won't. You know.
Right.
And it's really, and I guess the interesting thing about these things is it's a really like they're really really sensitive to just the slightest movements, and so you truly could subconsciously kind of control these, you know, like,
oh yeah,
I almost wonder if it would be a good lie detector test, you know, like
that's because I was just gonna say, I don't think that everybody who does this is like a hack. I think some people, I think if someone's trying to make money by doing, and not just this, like psychic readings, any of that stuff, I don't think that the people who believe in it are hacks. I think I understand why people do believe in these things. And a lot of times, like you're saying with this, it can seem to be confirmed without you trying to turn the rod.
Yeah, and
right?
That's kind of like in my research, I realized that a lot of it's actually kind of an interesting insight into people's psychology.
Yeah,
you know, like the ideomotor phenomenon or whatever is really kind of interesting, you know, like, I really, it'd be kind of fun to like, I could have you hold these and I can ask you like questions. Should we try it? Okay, but here's the thing, Joe. Sometimes I think our podcast should be more of a YouTube show because this would be a whole lot better if not.
I don't care. Let's
okay.
Go.
You gotta just try to put all confirmation bias aside. Okay.
So put all confirmation bias aside.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, Joe, have you ever kept Strava running while you're driving to make your ride look longer?
Put all confirmation bias aside?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm doing that. Can I use confirmation bias now?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, so he made them cross. Okay. Joe, have you ever stolen anything from a grocery store? Okay. The sticks went apart, so apparently Joe hasn't stolen anything. That's good. Joe, do you actually like me? He's spinning the two sticks in the air. So... Okay,
this should be every episode. We can never talk about bikes again after this. Okay. Peace and love. That's very dumb. That's extremely stupid. Yeah, because like, no, it's like, and this is, let me just describe, well, if anybody's lost, like we're dealing with like the sprinkler flags. It looks like that material bent and it sticks out like a foot.
Our marshmallow roasting sticks, I took them and I cut the ends off and bent them into an L shape.
So I have to try really hard to get them to not bend, first of all.
To not move.
To not move. To get this to hold still is tricky. I have to hold very, very still to get it to not move, right? So if your answer is predicated on it moving one way or the other, it is almost certainly going to move one way or the other. You're going to get an answer either way, right? And it's this very subtle movement of my wrist I can get it to point at people. Like this could almost be a magic trick, right?
But
where it's like the next person in the room who's going to die is going to be, you know.
But
like,
honestly, for me, Joe, when I walk past our water line, it is kind of weird for me because I truly think it seems like it moves.
Like, yeah.
And I
oh, it does move. I saw it move.
And I'm honestly not trying to make it move.
Yeah.
And like when I cross over or that water line and I do it and it goes through multiple rooms, it moves. And I know that it's probably me subconsciously doing it, but it literally is subconscious. Like I was almost like the first time you did it almost creeped me out a little bit because
I think you want it to work.
And that might be,
yeah,
but it really is subconscious and yeah. It's subconsciously making me move that just a bit.
So here's the thing. I didn't go into this like understanding really how to control the flag. Right. But I knew if I held, I was like, I'm genuinely going to hold very still and see if it does anything. Right. But even that's a confirmation bias of my own.
Because you were trying to not make it. Yeah.
No, but I was trying to hold still. Right. I was like, hey, if this is the magic, I want to see it. I'd love to see it. That'd be really cool if it worked. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I was like, I'm going to deliberately hold my hand very still. Right. I didn't understand really when I was watching you do this. I'm like, I didn't really understand how it was moving side to side like that. But all you do is you tilt your wrist and it moves. Right.
Yeah.
This would be better with YouTube, but,
yeah, Joe and I are both staring at a moving this stick around, but here,
what does it say about our podcast that we're talking about like a moving stick and it's five times as interesting as what we usually talk about?
No, but here's some information, like here's some facts that you just kind of throw out there. So farmers and ranchers historically used the dowsing rods to find water and to dig wells there.
Okay.
Okay. British troops used it to find water in the First World War.
Okay.
In the Vietnam War, Marines use it to locate weapons and tunnels.
Okay.
And the Norwegian army has used it to locate people buried in avalanches.
Cool. So we historically have burned witches for having hiccups.
But here, wait, no, I know.
Okay.
It was, and I thought this kind of shocked me a little bit. It was actually banned by the Catholic Church as a form of divination.
Okay. So, but what does that mean? Why is that? Of course,
I don't know.
It was.
Yeah. It means it's interesting.
That doesn't mean it works. They've banned all sorts of goofy stuff. Like,
So here's what, I mean, Joe's already has heroically debunked this for everybody. But here,
I know I'm not likable here. I know. I get it.
Wouldn't that be cool if like a bunch of like coat hangers could find underground water?
Yeah.
Like,
that'd be really cool. But
okay. Let's see. Science. I'm reading out of Wikipedia again. Mm-hmm. Science writers such as William Benjamin Carpenter, Malleus Culpin, and Martin Gardner accept the views of some dowsers that the movement of dowsing rods is a result of unconscious muscular action, which is kind of what we talked about. The view is widely accepted. Wait, this view is widely accepted amongst the scientific community. The dowsing apparatus is known to amplify slight movements of the hand caused by a phenomenon known as ideomotor response, which we talked about a second ago. People's subconscious minds may influence their bodies without consciously deciding to take action. This would make dowsing rods susceptible to the dowser's subconscious knowledge or perception and also to confirmation bias. Okay. Dowsing in all other respects is considered to be a
pseudoscience. Okay. I was kind of hoping there would be some sort of like magnetism or something.
No, here's the thing though.
Okay.
Water dowsing seems to have the best results when trying to locate water. There is,
as compared to what?
As compared to
other forms of dowsing, like looking
like looking for metals or looking for, and I actually like when I was getting ready for this, there's a lot of people that treat this almost like a Ouija board, and they'll ask like they'll pretend like they're asking some spirit questions, and then and then they'll ask the question, you know, and then the wires will cross, and then they make it all eerie and stuff. Like, that's obviously bogus.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of people that are convinced that it's a decent way to locate water, underground water. And the theory behind that is electromagnetic, that it disrupts that. But actually, in the research I did, water dowsers often achieve good results because random chance has a high probability of finding water in favorable terrain.
Yeah, I was going to say, because in a lot of areas, you can dig and you'll find. And like, what constitutes finding water? Because the deeper you dig, like usually the wetter the soil becomes, right? To an extent. All things being equal, eventually you'll find some kind of groundwater.
I mean, I guess this guy that was out with the excavator was looking for pipes. And he was using it to find pipes. And
but let's be clear. There is no scientific basis for what he's doing.
No, there's not.
Okay. Okay, because no. I heard that. I got excited. I'm like, oh, okay. So like people in the industry actually do this. There's something to it.
But there are actually people that, like a lot of farmers and ranchers to this day, still actually use this
but 10% of Americans actually believe the earth is flat. Like I don't know.
Not
like
10%.
It's a shockingly, disturbingly, and not coincidentally high number. How about that?
So yeah. Huh. So I don't know if that was interesting or not. I thought it was interesting. And yeah.
Hmm. Okay. You know what? That is interesting. I think confirmation bias is a fascinating thing.
It is too. And I thought that whole ideomotor phenomenon thing is really kind of interesting.
Because that, I'm going to start seeing that everywhere now. And I think that I'm not going to break the thing again. I'm not going to break our, we can't say the B word anymore. I had actually a connection to that with this.
But I'll go for it.
Sure. At the end of the episode, I think that this, we talk about confidence a lot, right? Let's say we'll use basketball instead, right? When you're on a hot streak making free throws, or when you're, I'm sure that like for Caitlin Clark and Steph Curry and like amazing three-pointer shooters, I think there's some of that must be going on there just with your confidence.
Oh, for
right?
sure.
That, like the really tiny little things that you do, or if you're confident that you can ride a section of trail versus like getting off your bike and looking at it and freaking out about it and then taking 20 tries where you ride up to the lip and then stop versus just riding it after your buddy does. That like the tiny little movements that your body makes physically when you're doing something that requires confidence, that this has to be related to that, right?
Oh, for sure. Like you think about like when you're walking with someone cool and you're really self-conscious about how to walk or something, mm-hmm.
or you just have that thought that like when you're doing the bottle flip back in 2016, where that was the coolest thing was to flip a water bottle. Like, I always wonder if you just like, if you're not thinking about it and just like feeling like you're going to do it and then doing it like that, there's gotta be a scientific basis for like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Right. Or like that, like I have the confidence to just ride any blue square trail anywhere in the world and be fine. But if I was going to do hard line or something, there's no way I could do it. Even though my body's capable of doing all those little moments without like the practice and the competence to trust myself doing that.
Yeah.
Or like, that's why like after a crash, you have a hard time getting back up and descending well again, right? Because your brain is hijacking you. And that is actually genuinely fascinating.
So,
huh?
Well,
your thing was more interesting than mine. Granted, I think mine needed so much more.
And I think mine would have been a better YouTube video, but you know, we're not.
Hey, we're being way too self-critical here. That was probably way more interesting than any episode we've done in the 12 months since the last one of these.
It's a pretty low bar.
Yeah. I was talking about it. I was talking to mom about it. I wouldn't mind peppering in some non-bike stuff. If you have an interesting thing you'd like to hear Dan and I talk about, I'm totally open to that. So, I can't guarantee we'll do all or any of them, but this was really interesting. Like thinking of a thing and going and learning about it. Cause like I said, my thing, what did I even start with? I think I started with what is the definition of a country? Cause I saw a really interesting video about that a while ago. That's like a really shaky thing, but I realized that was kind of boring. I was just looking at maps and I've kind of done that before. I'm like, ooh, what?
Well, that's how you discovered Eskdale.
That's how I discovered Eskdale.
And I want to ride my bike to Eskdale someday, but
yeah, read up on Eskdale. It's a weird place. Yeah. But yeah, that was interesting.
Yeah.
You actually made props for a podcast. That's awesome and hilarious. I wonder how that'll turn out just to listen to.
Probably pretty bad.
Feel free to give us your feedback unless it's like, critical.
For like both the people, unless it's critical.
Yeah, I was going to say. So Amy and Xander, let us know how dumb you thought this was. Well, everybody enjoy some well-deserved time off the B word. Rest
if you need it,
if you need it, right.
Listen to our previous episode for that.
Yeah. Wish all of our riders a good luck at Nationals. All of those who are going, Dan and I will catch you not this coming weekend, but the weekend after for our 100th episode.
Yeah, we should talk about something special like VO2 Max or something.
We should do the most boring. No, we'll have zone to. Two. You should ride Zone 2 and go to bed on time podcast ever.
yeah, well, I know. What do we do for our 100th episode? Like,
I don't know.
Our top 100 favorite.
Something. Our top 100 favorite zones. You'll never guess number two. I thought it would be funny. Part of me wanted to do, I had this idea where I was going to do like bike related clickbait articles and just trying to be funny. And I came up with like two that were kind of funny. And I was like, I can't fill 30 minutes with this and it's bike related.
We'll think of something special to do for our 100th episode.
Yeah. We'll do like a clip show. Maybe all the best moments.
Yeah. I'll fix my hair before the episode or something.
They can tell it's bad just by listening to it. Your ideomotor thing is telling us that you don't have any confidence in your hair. It's like, oh, so zone two.
I know. Like my ideomotor phenomenon's fighting me every podcast. Like usually I'm really well-spoken and I get all kind of shaky.
All ideo your mom's motor phenomenon. That sounded way funnier in my head. As do most things that I say. I don't know if climb off a ladder.
We never
probably
got
more climb out of a pit. I'm going to climb out of a pit and end this episode now. Everybody ride safe. And we will talk to you in a couple weeks with the first episode in the triple digits.
All right. Love you guys.
That was weird.
Can you believe that?